I'm speaking with Peter Bergen, who is the author of the new book, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. Peter Bergen is CNN's national security analyst and the director of the National Security Studies Program at the New America Foundation. He has traveled and reported extensively from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and recently Egypt. In 1997, he conducted the first television interview of Osama bin Laden for CNN. Peter Bergen's other books include Holy War, Inc., Inside the Secret World of Osama bin Laden, and The Osama bin Laden I Know, An Oral History of Al-Qaeda's Leader. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Bergen.
Thank you for the invitation, Ian.
Since you were just in Egypt and all of these revolutions that are roiling the Middle East and North Africa, I get a certain perverse pleasure out of it, in as much as these tectonic shifts in the politics of that region have marginalized Al-Qaeda, marginalized the Likud, and marginalized a lot of the left's favorite revolutionaries like Chavez and Ortega and Castro and, I suppose, to some extent, Ahmadinejad. Do you in any way share that feeling?
Well, it's also marginalized, you know, Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri. So, yeah, both on the kind of extreme right and the left, what's going on in Egypt. You know, what's interesting is that we've had polling data from around the Muslim world in, you know, great volume in the past decade. And surprise, surprise, Muslims around the Muslim world want exactly kind of what everybody else wants. They want an accountable government, some measure of prosperity, free press, independent judiciary. These are kind of classic kind of liberal values. And what they don't want is the Taliban.
But the interesting shoe that might drop, I spoke to a Saudi human rights dissident the other day, is Saudi Arabia. And of course, the Saudis have often been referred to as the Taliban with oil.
Well, you know, that's the big enchilada. There are all sorts of reasons why Saudi Arabia might be more, or is more stable, and might prove more stable in the future. One, of course, is King Abdullah, who's arguably the most impressive Saudi king since King Faisal, and is widely loved and revered. I've spent a lot of time in Saudi Arabia, and you know, even people who are in the political opposition like King Abdullah. Second, of course, they have a lot of money they can bribe people with in one form or another. Thirdly, they are the quote-unquote defender of the holy places, a title they assumed in 1986. And of course, they are closely linked to the Al Saud, which is the Wahhabi religious family, which is effectively the second royal family in the Saudi Arabia. It's the alliance between the Wahhabis and the Sauds that has gone on since the 18th century. And of course, this is the third Saudi monarchy. There's been three different sets of Al Saud monarchies since this 18th century. So all those things together suggest that Saudi Arabia is not Bahrain. The Shia population is relatively small. That said, of course, you know, it is a absolute monarchy. They've made some minor changes. I was there in 2005 when they had the first election they've had for a long time in Saudi Arabia, but it was only a municipal election in Riyadh, the capital. And so they must be looking at all this thinking, what do we need to do? And of course, King Abdullah is in poor health, and his immediate potential successors are all in their 80s. And I think the Saudi royal family must be doing some serious soul-searching about what is the next best way forward.
And of course, if there's been some rumors for some time that Prince Nayef and his son Prince Mohammed, the interior minister, and his sidekick have been running the show while Abdullah's been sick, and he's widely despised within the kingdom. So if he succeeds Abdullah, then I think there would be a lot of discontent.
I'm not sure he's widely despised. I mean, what gives you that
belief? Oh, that was the impression that I got from the Saudis that I've spoken to, particularly these human rights people. But
well,
they said, you know, they were, I mean, actually they, saying,
they,
sorry.
They run the interior ministry, and so that, of course, would be. But I've met, you know, the son, you know, Prince Nayef Senior again is in his 80s.
Right.
You know, the whatever happens to King Abdullah, the next king is going to be very much an interim king, and they're going to have to go down to the next generation. Prince Nayef Junior is actually, I think, quite an impressive guy, who might well be the next king if, you know, in terms of a longer term succession. Of course, and they decide this by consensus. It's not primogeniture in a sort of British monarchical sense. There is, you know, it can skip generations, and people have to agree on who the next king will be. It's not necessarily just you know, just because you're the oldest.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Peter Bergen, the author of The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. And just getting onto your book, Peter, the subtitle suggests, and many people have suggested this, that we've been goaded into an endless war by a hopeless fanatic.
Well, you know, he certainly would like to make it an endless war. I call the book The Longest War simply because it is the longest war in American history. It's certainly not the most important war. The Civil War, World War II, the Cold War, even the Vietnam War are all more important than this war. But it's the one we're in right now. And certainly bin Laden sees it as a generational struggle. You know, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two in al-Qaeda, has said in his sort of autobiography that it took 2 centuries to get the Crusaders out of the Middle East. It took 140 years to get the French out of Algeria. You know, that's the kind of timeline that, you know, these guys are not concerned about next year. They're playing a long game. But it's a game that they're losing.
And your book begins with the months preceding September 11th, 2001. And Peter Bergen, I'm absolutely mystified how this truth of movement developed in this country. And in a curious way, the truthers who believe that 9/11 was an inside job and that Bush and Cheney are these evil geniuses, they actually, to my mind, are dignifying Bush and Cheney, who in your book are clearly could be charged with the reckless endangerment of the United States for ignoring manifest evidence.
Yeah, well, certainly incompetence. You know, I mean, Occam's razor is a pretty useful philosophical tool to look at any human endeavor, which is the simplest explanation is probably the best one. And incompetence is usually a better explanation of almost every human activity than conspiracy. Conspiracy implies far too much competence in the human beings who are by their nature not usually very competent. And certainly the Bush administration, you know, fell down. I say in the book that the 9/11 Commission, which did this amazing piece of historical research and was sort of designed not to assign particular culpability to particular people, it was really designed to look at institutional culpabilities, of which there were plenty of culpabilities to go around. But because it was bipartisan, it didn't really take a position on who on the Bush administration really was asleep at the switch. But if you read the footnotes of the 9/11 report, there's a ton of really good, interesting evidence in those footnotes, emails that went to Condoleezza Rice from various of the counterterrorism people inside the National Security Council. You know, the numbers of cabinet meetings devoted to terrorism before 9/11 were only 1 out of 33. You know, there's an avalanche of evidence showing that, contrary to what Condoleezza Rice said when she testified before the 9/11 Commission, that the Bush administration was at battle stations in the summer of 2001. In fact, they were far from at battle stations. And in fact, President Bush took the longest presidential vacation in 3 decades in the summer of 2001, despite all the information that was coming in to the CIA and even to him that things were, you know, that there was a big plot afoot.
But Peter Bergen, in your book, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda, you do recount the Battle for Tora Bora as the single most consequential battle in the War on Terror. And without getting conspiratorial, it is still mystifying why Rumsfeld kept blocking requests from the Special Forces people on the ground to block bin Laden's exit. I mean, what's your final conclusion on that? I mean, I know...
Well, my final conclusion was based on an email interview I conducted with General Tommy Franks, in which he said, yes, that request did come up the chain from the CIA leader, Hank Crumpton, who was running the Afghan operation, which had been in turn precipitated by the CIA guy on the ground, Gary Burnson. And, you know, they were requesting a Ranger battalion, i.e. 800 soldiers, to come in and help try and kind of tamp down the Tora Bora area, because they knew bin Laden was there. I mean, there was multiple sources of evidence that bin Laden was there. The U.S. Special Forces official history of the battle, which I drew upon, says that between December 9th and 14th, 2001, there were multiple sources of intelligence, mostly radio intercepts, that bin Laden was actually at Tora Bora. And at one point, you know, U.S. soldiers were only perhaps 2 kilometers from his, they could use direction-finding technology to see where he was. And Franks basically has said that he didn't approve more soldiers because he was concerned about more American soldiers on the ground being antibodies for the Afghans, that the intelligence on bin Laden's presence at Tora Bora wasn't very clear, which, by the way, is nonsensical, and a number of other things. But the point is that or you know, just as an aside, in Tommy Franks' defense, you know, Rumsfeld went to him right at the height of the Battle of Tora Bora, and told him to rewrite the war plan for Iraq. Now, the war plan for Iraq at that time was an 800-page document, and they had a week to rewrite it in. And they were already working 7 days a week, 16 hours a day. So, the fact is that what had worked very well to overthrow the Taliban, limited numbers of U.S. special forces on the ground, supported by CIA officers and, you know, thousands of Northern Alliance soldiers, failed at the Battle of Tora Bora.
Well, just to go back a little bit before this, I hosted a forum at the UCLA Hammer Forum recently with a very experienced anthropologist in Afghanistan, Thomas Barfield, and the head of the Pashto service for VOI, Spasmai Maywandi. And she's the only person to have interviewed Mullah Omar both before and after 9/11. And they were talking about how Mullah Omar had, in fact, offered up bin Laden to Prince Turki, who's Prince Nayef's predecessor, head of Saudi intelligence, and the Saudis didn't want this guy, and they wanted the Americans to get him. What's your understanding of that? In other words, was this looks like a missed opportunity to have prevented 9/11? In other words, there's no way that Mullah Omar...
My friend and colleague and boss, Steve Cole, has literally written the book on this, and,
right.
And whether in Ghost Wars or in the 9/11 Commission report, that's a slightly garbled version of what actually happened. The Saudis were quite keen to get bin Laden, and Prince Turki, you know, went to Afghanistan and did some negotiation, and at one point Mullah Omar said he would hand over bin Laden, but then the embassy attacks happened in Africa, the United States responded with cruise missiles, and after that Mullah Omar basically changed his mind about expelling bin Laden. There were plenty of missed opportunities along the way, whether it was the Saudis trying to get bin Laden out of Afghanistan, or whether it was a series of plans to snatch or kill bin Laden using cruise missiles or CIA assets on the ground.
Again, I'm speaking with Peter Bergen, author of The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. But in the broader sense, do you think, Peter Bergen, that Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabis that you were talking about earlier have had a profound effect on radicalizing Pakistan and Afghanistan, and how would you compare that to bin Laden's effect?
It's a very complicated question because, you know, there are tens of millions of Saudis who wouldn't describe themselves as Wahhabis. They would describe themselves as perhaps Salafis or just, you know, fundamentalists in their religion. And, you know, very, very few of them have gone on to engage in violence, relatively speaking. On the other hand, Al-Qaeda, according to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, in the operational commander of 9/11, he has said that something like 70% of the recruits coming to Al-Qaeda's training camps were coming from Saudi Arabia. So certainly Saudi Arabia has had many of the key members of Al-Qaeda have come out of Saudi Arabia, and that's just a fact. And of course, Al-Qaeda in the Saudi Arabia was a very virulent organization which mounted a very violent campaign against the Saudi government and the Saudi population beginning in May of 2003, as a result of which the Saudi government arrested thousands of people, killed 150 jihadist terrorists, really mounted a very, very successful campaign against Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia, which has basically been defeated. So there's a lot of paradoxes here, because Al-Qaeda, at the end of the day, what do they want? They want to get rid of the Saudi regime. That's their main goal. And so the idea that the Saudis have been instrumental in the rise of Al-Qaeda would be kind of strange if they were promoting something that was actually interested in their own demise.
So do you think the emphasis on madrasas and the money that's poured in and refugee camps that became the kind of breeding ground for a lot of the Taliban, you know, I keep hearing, in spite of a lot of evidence to the contrary, that a lot of people insist that there are links between, an ideological comfort zone, if you will, between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban leadership?
Well, there are. I mean, it depends which part of the Taliban you're talking about. The Haqqani network, which is based in North Waziristan in Pakistani's tribal regions, is protecting Al-Qaeda right now, and the Haqqani network is arguably the most effective of the Taliban militia groups. On the other hand, you know, the Mullah Omar group, which is in southern Afghanistan and western Pakistan, you know, their ties to Al-Qaeda are much less clear, and so it depends which element of the Taliban you're talking about with. But as a general principle, the Taliban has protected Al-Qaeda and continues to do so. So there's certainly some, you know, there's a commonality of goals to some degree there. And in fact, the Pakistani Taliban, as you well know, sent a suicide bomber to Times Square in May of 2010. And so here you've got the Taliban acting in a much more like al-Qaeda-like manner.
And but the Haqqani network is also very connected to the ISI, isn't it? I mean,
it is.
There's a sense now, at least, there's been some indications that the CIA, either contractor or officer, who is under arrest in Pakistan, may have shot a couple of ISI operatives. So it may be a kind of spy war going on here between the Inter-Service Intelligence Agency of Pakistan and the CIA.
Yeah, I don't really know. But clearly this story of Raymond Davis, the CIA contractor who shot and killed two Pakistanis, is a huge story in Pakistan, and already the Pakistani-American relationship is never really that great, and this has really put a huge dent in it.
The ISI certainly connected to or protecting Haqqani, right? I mean, would that be?
Yeah, I mean, they are. Yeah, it's all very murky, but they are at least acquiescing in their continued existence and maybe even supporting in some respects their operations against India and Afghanistan. For instance, the attack on the Indian embassy was a Haqqani network plan and may have had some ISI support, according to both U.S. and Afghan officials.
Again, I'm speaking with Peter Bergen, whose new book, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. We are discussing it in a very important work in terms of not just America's reaction to 9/11, but also reveals a lot of what happened on the other side, if you will, how splits are evident and enduring amongst Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden has made mistakes, according to a lot of them, and killing a lot of Muslims, but also from the there was a fundamental difference over tactics versus strategy. Is that, I guess that continues, right, in terms of whether attacking America was worth losing the haven in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I mean, Bin Laden is a smart guy. He's intelligent, he's well-informed, but that doesn't make him a great strategist. And his strategy of attacking the United States on 9/11 was to get the United States to pull out of the Middle East, and the authoritarian regimes like the Mubarak regime and the Saudi regime would then fall. And he based that analysis on the idea that the United States was as weak as the Soviet Union. So once the Soviet Union fell, its client regimes in Eastern Europe also fell. But that was a very naive analysis of the United States. And just because we pulled out of the Vietnam and pulled out of Beirut in the 80s and pulled out of Somalia in the 90s didn't mean that we're going to pull out of the Middle East because we were attacked in New York and Washington. And of course, quite the reverse happened. We had occupied Afghanistan, occupied Iraq, drew closer to the Saudis and to the Mubarak regime based on our shared goal of defeating al-Qaeda. And so Bin Laden's entire strategy didn't make any sense. And there were some smart people in al-Qaeda, even before 9/11, who were telling him attacking the United States actually might be kind of a dumb idea. And one of the people I interview in the book, you know, talked to him directly in the summer of 2001, essentially saying, do not attack the United States. It's really would be very counterproductive for our immediate goal, which is to basically get rid of these dictatorships and monarchies in the Middle East. Well, and in fact, it turned out that it was people power that did it in the Middle East, and that was nothing to do with al-Qaeda and had nothing to do with the attack on 9/11.
And that, of course, Peter Bergen, isn't a supreme irony, given Bin Laden's rather bizarre analysis of what was happening, that the ripe fruit that would fall to his caliphate, if you will, when in fact they appear to be falling to some social media-driven desire for democracy in connection with the rest of the world.
Yeah, it's a great irony, and I'm sure Bin Laden isn't enjoying savoring it. You've had Ayman al-Zawahiri, his number two, has released, I think, three or four tapes now trying to insert al-Qaeda into the events that are going on in Egypt and elsewhere in the Middle East, and they're basically a big dud. No one's paying any attention to them.
Can you make the case that we've been wrong-footed from the beginning with 9/11? There, after all, in New York, where the funeral pyre was still smoldering, we could have organized the UN, and after all, the best way to get terrorists abroad is through cooperation with the host countries. Instead, we sort of went it alone. President Bush declared this war on terror, and in doing so, he appeared to elevate Bin Laden as an equal player on the world stage, and there were allusions to him being the next Hitler, etc. and that we have also conflated bin Laden with jihadis and the very notion of jihad having a religious connotation, why we never call him a criminal as opposed to somebody on a spiritual quest. I mean, it just seems like our missteps are the gift that keep on giving.
Well, we've certainly made some missteps, but Al-Qaeda has made a whole set of missteps which it hasn't learned from. So, you know, I agree with you. I mean, I think one of President Bush's main conceptual errors was to turn Al-Qaeda into the existential threat it hoped to be rather than the actual real enough threat it was. And sort of when he spoke to the nation and to Congress 9 days after 9/11, he implied that this was similar to the fight against fascism or communism, and that just didn't make any sense. The Nazis instigated a global conflict that killed tens of millions of people. If the Cold War had ended with a bang instead of a whimper, you and I and everybody listening to this conversation would have been dead. And so that's really existential. Al-Qaeda was a threat, but it's not an existential threat. There were some good things about the way Bush handled it. The initial the plan in Afghanistan was, you know, quite a thoughtful one with George Tenet. But a lot of mistakes were also made: coercive interrogations, denying the Geneva Conventions at Guantanamo. They were unnecessary, counterproductive, and it turned out the Supreme Court said they were also not legal. And many mistakes were made, but as a society, the United States has learned from its mistakes. And as a group, Al-Qaeda doesn't really learn from its mistakes. It just kind of keeps on going. And violence is its only real kind of calling card. And the tactics have taken over the strategy. It doesn't really have a real strategy. It's just calling for more violence and Taliban-style regimes from Indonesia to Morocco. And it turns out that most Muslims don't want any part of that. They saw what the Taliban looked like in action in Afghanistan, and they're not impressed.
But just in closing, when will we stop taking our shoes off at the airports?
I think we'll be continuing that forever. I mean, once these security things are in place, they're very hard to stop. And of course, just because Al-Qaeda may be losing the war of ideas in the Muslim world doesn't mean some other terrorist group may not want to put a bomb on a plane, either packed into somebody's sneakers or a plastic explosive or whatever. I mean, Al-Qaeda is not the only group of violent nihilists out there. There are others.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Peter Bergen, and for your book, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. I've been speaking with Peter Bergen, who is the author of the new book, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. Peter Bergen is CNN's National Security Analyst and the Director of the National Security Studies Program at the New America Foundation. His other books include Holy War Incorporated, Inside the Secret World of Osama bin Laden, and The Osama bin Laden I Know, An Oral History of Al-Qaeda's Leader.